31, and Christian. You're the only person who signed up. Senator Farioli, this is his bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Ann Christian. I'm appearing on behalf of both the Judicial Department and the Public Defense Services Commission. Senate Bill 641 makes it expressly clear that recovery of indigent defense costs can be assessed by the court in post-conviction relief cases. There's been some question about this, and this bill makes it expressly so. We have a number of post-conviction relief cases, many of them coming out of Eastern Oregon, and both the Commission and the Judicial Department support the bill.
All right. Senator Farioli, this is your bill. Do you have anything to say about it?
It's a good bill, Mr. Chairman, and I hope it passes.
Any questions of Ann? Do a work session on Senate Bill 641.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move Senate Bill 641 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 641 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Hearing no, sir. Senator Farioli, you get to carry your own bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'll support your dissent.
No, sir.
All right. Thank you. And let's do a little. I want to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 729. This is a simple little bill that expands the collection of buccal swabs to persons convicted of a misdemeanor. Sponsored by yours truly.
Simple little bill.
Simple little bill. That's correct. Yes.
I'll keep that in mind, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Said I get cautionary. All right. I think what I wanted to do, and I wanted to have the Department of State Police, who signed up neutral, and I've asked them to come and talk to us about the success and or failure of the bill we passed last session dealing with the collection of buccal swabs for convicted felons in the state of Oregon. And if we could do that to kind of lay a foundation for what this process is, and then Kevin Campbell, if you want to come up with them, we'll start with that. And what I was hoping is to have the Department of State Police talk a little bit about, you know, buccal swabs, what they are a little bit, and how they're collected, and then a kind of a list of successes or failures, and et cetera, et cetera. You know, the drill here. And then also, I don't know if our council's found the information, but Congress recently authorized or appropriated about $2 billion to the states for the purpose of DNA collection or backlogs or whatever. Perhaps you know a little bit more about that, Mr. Schimmelbach. You want to state your name for the record?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Schimmelbach. I'm in your Interim Forensic Services Division Director, State Police. Appearing here today representing the division regarding Senate Bill 729. Before we actually get into 729, with the Chair's permission, I'd like to do a little bit of a history lesson to show how we got this particular bill.
Yes, absolutely.
In 2001, the legislature passed House Bill 2664, and it basically required a collection of a buccal swab from all persons convicted of felonies in the state of Oregon. And it mandated certain members of the correction facility to collect this swab and turn it into the state police forensics division. When submitted, we analyzed and updated both our local database called CODIS and the national database called INDIS for being able to do searches on unsolved crimes against this particular convicted offender profile. We were authorized two FTEs in that bill without funding, and we were given $400,000, $200,000 at first, and $200,000 to follow through the e-board. We were never able to fill the two FTEs. We never were able to collect the second $200,000. The work that I'm about to review for you came predominantly by reorganizing that unit and getting some residual DNA grant funds to have the samples run through a contract laboratory. Prior to the implementation of House Bill 2664, we had approximately 19,000 convicted offenders in our database. because of 2664, we were able to add another 33,000 and change samples to that database. This resulted in an additional 138 cold hits. And a cold hit is when you have an unsolved crime, no known suspect, and you run the profile of the DNA through the database, and it hits to one of these convicted offenders. It's very useful information for investigation. I think you can all see that. It has met with really good success in that for about every 300 of these samples that we put into the database, we will receive a cold hit. So the return on the investment is a very good return for the dollar spent. The current backlog is around 6,000 to 7,000 samples because the grant funds have expired and our staffing levels have been reduced, and that is growing at the rate of about 1,400 samples a month without this particular bill 729. We do expect some more grant money to become available. Senator Menas, the chair, mentioned some DNA grant funds that are coming out of the federal government. We do not know, because it has not been announced yet, what those particular grant funds will be targeted for, but we believe we can pick up some to do some of the off-site subcontracting of these samples. Now, specifically to this bill adds all Class A misdemeanor convictions to the existing law that collects a sample from all convicted felons. The method of collection through the corrections department is what we call, with the use of what we call a buccal swab, which is nothing more than like a cotton swab that you may have around your house. Not exactly, but for this purpose you can understand. And they swab the inside of the cheek. It's a very non-invasive procedure. They collect it and dry it and turn it into the forensics division, where we then cause to be typed or type ourselves the DNA profile for the particular individual. This particular bill, 729, we project to add an additional 7,000 samples per year, all of which will go to the backlog because we currently do not have funding or staff to be able to process these. Our particular position on this bill is neutral. We think it's a very good idea, but with experiencing a 60% reduction in staff and corresponding operational costs, we cannot support this bill because of the funding alone. We're projecting for a biennium that a cost of $1.98 million, and the reason why this is so high is because to be able to reach the misdemeanors, we are prioritized in the bill to do all the felonies first. Without any funding to do the felonies or the misdemeanors, the roll-up cost is for both the felonies and the misdemeanors, and thus we have the $1.98 million cost. We will need position authority for four FTEs. Those particular costs associated with those four FTEs are included in the $1.98 million. At that point, I believe I'll stop and take questions from the...
Right. Have you seen the Dash 1 amendment, by the way?
No, I haven't.
I've got it here.
It just simply makes it effective in July 2005, which circumvents the fiscal issue for this biennium. But we'll keep it. Well, and I think that's what I want to get into. It's kind of a discussion a little bit about the utility of the collection of DNA and how valuable it is, because my experience, I don't have it in my case file, but I had requested from the Department of State this list of the kinds of hits that you receive. And given the fact that I work in the sex crimes detail in the Portland Police Bureau, many of the cases that we're talking about here are sex offenders and rape cases, and in some cases murder. So there are a lot of sexual assault cases that are clear, or at least the suspect is identified as a result of this. So I guess from my perspective as the author of the bill or sponsor of the bill, to leave a victim or, you know, someone who's been impacted substantially by being sexually assaulted without the possibility of a resolution to their case, I think, has a cost associated with it, too. So the legislature, I think, needs to try to look at what are we doing and how are we doing it and why are we doing it. The other thing that I wanted to bring out was, I think in times past, there was an assumption that if a person was a sex offender, they were a sex offender. If they were a property crimes person, they were a property crimes person. I think what we're seeing, and we bring some more data to the committee some future time, is that that assumption is not true. That in many cases, persons who have low-level convictions for property crimes, in fact, have been engaged in other kinds of felony sexual assault, and in some cases, homicide. And so I don't know if you can speak to those, or if you brought in those documents about what you're currently getting in the 138 hits that you did get since the 2001 session. Do you have that with you, or should...
Mr. Chairman, I don't have it with me, but I can affirm what you're saying in that all previous conceptions that person crimes follow person crimes and property crimes follow property crimes, we have found to be not true. A convicted rapist could come from an unauthorized use of a motor vehicle conviction. A murderer could come from a drug conviction. We're seeing no pattern at all, and certainly it's dispelling the myths that we had prior to this bill.
Right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kevin Campbell, Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. Chief Mike Healy from Lebanon was going to be here this morning as well and could not make it. Both of us serve on what's called the Forensics Liaison Committee. It's a committee in cooperation with Oregon State Police. Our association is very, very interested in the whole forensics division and their work for good reason. And I don't think there's any mystery as to why the whole area of DNA is not only important here in our state, but has taken on a great deal of national prominence and attention and funding. And I think one of the critical pieces of our pursuit of this kind of policy is that I believe the federal government will move more and more to this approach, and there will be funding attached and made available to the states that I believe we need to be positioned to take advantage of. One of the nice things is that potentially the federal government continues to be a partner in our forensics division here on a state level. We play our part, but there is money available increasingly for these uses, and I think it's important for us to take advantage of it. On a policy level, our association is 100% behind this approach. I think that DNA has opened whole new worlds of solvability in terms of investigations. It takes what is sometimes a series of crimes and reduces it, helps reduce it to an individual who in the past could never be identified specifically as the cause of a chain of events. I think that DNA provides now a footprint that we can follow in the situation where someone is a recidivist and is involved in a multiple level of different crimes. As Dave Schmierbach has mentioned already, that they, in fact, are not just limited to their own crime category, but they move back and forth among different levels and types of crime because a lot of these things are connected. So whether it's a sexual crime or a crime of property crime, I believe this is incredibly important to law enforcement as we continue to work smart in the area of crime solvability. I think that DNA is one of the best tools we've had in many, many years from a law enforcement perspective. Now, I know, and the purpose of the Dash 1 amendments, of course, is because of our difficult fiscal environment, but I'm a big fan of moving forward with policies that recognize the fact that we will not always be in the situation that we're in today, and that we have to continue to build a system that can respond into the future and that's healthy. I think that the Forensics Division, in all of our encouragements of the legislature, and thankfully your actions to date, have recognized that forensics is extremely important and that this policy, which expands the type of buccal swabs we are taking, made available for the purpose of identifying, connecting people with crimes, is something we ought to move forward with, even in a difficult economic time. And if we need to delay the effective date, so be it, but I think we need to continue to position ourselves again as a state that is on the front lines and on the aggressive stance towards participating with the federal government and others as they want to move forward with this. So with that, Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for the committee's time and for your bill.
Mr. Campbell, thank you very much. David, could you explain a little bit about when you hire a forensic scientist? You're assuming a bill passed this session and was implemented during this biennial at $1.9 million roughly. what kind of persons do you hire? What are the backgrounds? And what are you looking for in a DNA scientist or a forensic scientist?
Well, we would hire not just scientists. We would try to utilize lab technicians whenever possible. But certainly there would be scientists hired in here. A DNA scientist has a minimum Bachelor of Science degree in a hard science, and it has prerequisites that they have to have had education in some of the advanced biochemical sciences and statistics. And those are becoming increasingly harder and harder to find that are trained, because there's a huge demand for them nationwide. And so most likely we would be hiring somebody relatively new out of school and training them up, which usually is about a year to 2 years to ramp somebody up to where they can actually perform independent casework. If we were successful and able to find somebody and hire them directly in, it would still be 6 months before we could get somebody up and operational because of the particular training program that Oregon has modeled after the national accredited system that we're participating in. And Mr. Chairman, with your permission, to the Dash 1 amendment?
Yes, of course.
This particular Dash 1 amendment meets our particular need for the upcoming biennium, obviously deferring this implementation date. We speak to the policy that is in Senate Bill 729. We're in favor of the policy. We found great successes in that House Bill 2664. It is strictly staffing and costs that we are neutral on this bill.
All right, good. And just as background, too, where in the structure and organization of Oregon State Police, where does forensic science fit? How much of a priority is it, or can you speak to that?
I don't know the priority of the whole organization. It usually starts at my level and goes down.
Right. Has the leadership of the Oregon State Police, the superintendent, ever held any discussions with command staff regarding what priority forensics is within the organization?
If he has, he hasn't done it in my presence, so I couldn't speak to it.
Well, perhaps we'll have to ask the superintendent to show up.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's a good place to go for that.
Thank you, sir. Well, and I guess I'm going to state my bias. I think that forensic science is, along with computer science and evidence recovery, video evidence recovery and technology, are probably three of the largest, the fastest growing areas of evidence recovery, and it's changing, I think, the face of law enforcement, particularly investigations and the ability to solve crimes, which is why investigators exist, and I think why police departments to some extent exist. It's not a primary function necessarily. You want to prevent crime, but at the same time, when people are victimized, you want to be able to come to a healthy resolution successfully. Having, again, served as a sex crimes detective and worked with a lot of victims, it's almost impossible to describe what a victim goes through. And when you're the detective and you tell them that you can't get to their case because of personnel issues, or you can't get to their case because the evidence has been submitted and the crime lab can't get to it, it's pretty tough sitting there listening to somebody go through the emotional trauma that they go through. And particularly if you know in your heart of hearts as a detective that you can solve the case, or at least come to some resolution by knowing what forensic evidence exists or doesn't exist, you know, that changes the whole environment. It gives hope to people who've been victimized. So I think this is a priority, should be a priority for the state of Oregon. So whether it's this bill or some reasonable facsimile thereof, I think we ought to be talking about how the Oregon State Police are organized and what their primary functions are and what their objectives are in terms of solving crime statewide. That's my political dissertation. Anybody else have any comments, political diatribe, Senator
Chairman, I actually had a question for either of you, probably. State Police forensics would be the one to answer it. But in recent years, or fairly recently, they have come to question the value of fingerprints. Sometimes mistakes are made in fingerprints. And I remember for years and years we all thought, well, fingerprint, that's a definitive identification. And my question to you is, with DNA, as it gets to be used more and more, are you finding that it's as definitive as you thought earlier? And I'm specifically interested
in whether there are cases where family members might be confused on, upon DNA analysis. Are you finding that, like I think in the O.J. Simpson case, they said something like 1 in 3 million probability or some huge probability. As it gets to be used more and more, what is happening to these probability statistics?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, the science is being refined almost daily, and thus, as with any refinement, the probability of someone else having that same profile is becoming less and less and less, or in your terms, it's now like 1 in 30 billion that somebody else might have that same profile.
So the range is broadening rather than narrowing.
Yes. We do not say that it is an absolute identity, although we're approaching that. There are, 4 billion souls on the face of this earth, I believe, at this time. So if you have 1 in 30 billion as the odds of somebody duplicating that, you can do your own statistics, I think.
Is 1 in 30 billion correct? I mean, is that really what it is?
That is what we can approach, depending upon how good the sample is and how many loci that we can actually type. And a full profile will approach that probability, yes.
All right. Thank you very much. Any other questions?
One other question for Council.
Council?
Mm-hmm. Could you please, thank you, Mr. Chair, could you please just run through some crimes that are Class A misdemeanors?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, I'd be happy to. Class A misdemeanors. The ones that used to be, Senator Walker, under the bill or under the laws that currently are, sex abuse in the third degree is a Class A misdemeanor. But there are a variety. DUII, for example, is a Class A misdemeanor. Assault in the fourth degree, which is a simple assault, is a Class A misdemeanor. I'm going to guess that.
Excuse me, counsel, like a bar fight? Would be a simple.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, I think that's a scenario where, it's any assault. It would be intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly causing physical injury. It could be a bar fight. It could be a domestic violence assault.
Okay.
It could be even a car wreck where there's a reckless cause of injury. And I'm going to guess that Ms. Skye is going to have a whole litany of cases that are Class A misdemeanors.
Probably
so I just want to give you a kind of a definitely a breadth. Yeah, I could do that.
I think you'll find the whole broad scope of different types of offenses.
Okay. Thank you, Chair.
It runs again. Senator Burry.
Can I do a diatribe now?
Of course. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I have real concerns about the huge scope of this bill for fiscal and privacy reasons, or for lack of a better word, but I just want to echo the chairman's concern about the priority that should be placed on forensics. It's not one of those things that the public is aware of because they don't see them out on the streets, but it is really the lifeblood of the whole criminal justice system, and I would certainly support the chairman if we try to get maybe the superintendent in and really get some answers and some reassurances that forensics is going to have its proper role, because all the law enforcement agencies depend on it. And victims.
Right, and actually, Senator, you raised one of the interesting issues. I think maybe the ACLU will talk about it. That's the privacy issue. And probably should go back and have a little bit more discussion about which loci are identified and which ones are used for identifying persons and get into that a little bit. Because I think once we get into it, I think most people will be pretty comfortable with the fact that medical evidence is not, medical traits are not part of the 13 loci used for identification purposes and how that whole process works. So, if you don't mind, we'll have you stand down and we'll kind of get through some more testimony. I want to kind of lay the foundation for this bill. We'll bring it back at another time and talk a little bit more in depth about this. And hopefully we'll have some dialogues with the superintendent and the governor's office and some others about organizational structure and priorities of the Department of State Police. And I think that it's very, if you watch CSI and these television programs that are now emerging, having been a detective and been at murder scenes and, you know, where some of our forensic scientists are using different types of methodologies, a lot of what you're seeing, although it's television, is not too far from the truth. it's very advanced, and they speed everything up, and they use, you know, some stuff that's clearly fiction. And the environment's a little bit fiction, but it does, in fact, identify some of the potential successes. It's absolutely fascinating. If you've ever been to a crime scene, which you wouldn't be unless you're a detective, where you go through and they use process of amino black to identify blood evidence and argon laser technology to identify, you know, blood prints and cleaned up crime scenes, et cetera, et cetera. It's absolutely fascinating. Blood spatter that's identified from the use of argon laser, these kind of methodologies. Again, absolutely fascinating. And where you can identify blood evidence in a crime scene, I happen to have one where if you walked in the home, you would not have been able to tell that there had been a murder there. But when you do the argon laser, it literally lights up as if it was a fresh crime scene. It's a phenomenal process. So science, I think, in law enforcement is the way of the future. Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate you being cooperative. Chris, is it Stringer? Stringer.
Good morning, Chair Minnis, members of the committee. My name for the record is Chris Stringer. I'm a deputy district attorney in Benton County, Oregon, and I'm representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and we're in support of this bill. Many of the arguments have been echoed by the chiefs of police, council. Just quite simply, we believe it's good policy. DNA really are the fingerprints of the 21st century. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have about prosecution and as it relates to taking DNA samples.
All right. Any questions? There are none. Thank you, Mr. Stringer. Appreciate your time. I think what I'm going to do now, since Senator Brown is present, I think we'll redeem the time and transition here. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 2729, excuse me. And Senator Brown, you're here on Senate Bill 610.
That's correct.
Public hearing on Senate Bill 610. Council, you want to tell us what this bill does?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 610 is a bill that deals with crime victims being allowed to attend criminal proceedings. It would mandate that covered employers, and you can look at the definition of that, meaning employers with a certain amount of employees, would have to give time off for a crime victim to attend criminal proceedings. As a note, crime victim, you can also see the definition would be of an actual victim of a crime, and then in the case of a homicide, a member of the immediate family of the decedent. And so the other thing I would mention is there is a portion in Section 3 as there can be a showing of undue hardship by the employer, but it deals with getting crime victims to proceedings, and it would include, excuse me, juvenile and criminal cases. Sorry.
Senator.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, committee members. For the record, State Senator Kate Brown represents Senate District 21. As your good committee staff explained to you, Senate Bill 610 expands the definition of a crime victim to include members of the immediate family. Under current law, crime victims are allowed to attend court proceedings without losing their jobs. It doesn't make any sense that family members cannot also attend these same court proceedings when their loved ones are victims of violent crimes. You should have in front of you the -1 amendments. The bill currently applies only to the crime of homicide. In talking with advocates of the bill, we have talked about expanding it to include any violent crime. Senate Bill 610 specifies that if a business should be placed undue hardship while this is happening, an employee may work with the prosecuting attorney to set a court schedule that takes the family member into consideration when scheduling a court proceeding. As you will note from the bill, it only applies to employers that have 25 or more employees, not impacting small businesses. I actually got this proposal from the former Attorney General of Arizona, Janet Napolitano, who, as you know, is now the governor of Arizona. She thought it was one of the things that she had done that really had a direct impact on victims' lives and the families of those victims. She felt like it really made a difference, and I thought it was a good thing for us to have a discussion about. And I would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Chairman.
Senator Brady.
This amendment broadens it out considerably.
Substantially, yes.
I remember, and this is in a different, it's in Washington, D.C., my one and hopefully only experience as a crime victim. I ended up going to court seven times before it finally got scheduled. I finally just called up and said, if you want me to show up again, you have to send the marshals. Ended up having it, but it was a huge, because of postponements and that sort of thing, it would have been a huge disruption for many employers, or for several employers, if this had applied to me. I guess counsel has left the room, but he's back
in
there.
The audience, right?
I just want to kind of get a sense of how this would have an impact on business, given Oregon's criminal justice system, because thankfully I haven't been a criminal crime victim here. Are postponements typical, and how do you feel that should be addressed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, while the amendment deletes homicide, I do believe it should be limited to cover only violent crimes, and I think I would be happy to work with some of the other proponents of the bill to define that more clearly so that it wouldn't apply to all of the crimes. In terms of our court system, my experience with our criminal justice system, at least my experience in Multnomah County, is that it runs better than the experiences you had in D.C., though I have not had any recent experience after the substantial cuts, but my experience both as a lawyer and as a juror was that things ran pretty well. But committee counsel can probably answer that question better than I can.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Burdick, I think I heard your question. I was talking to Mr. Coolidge.
It was about experience of the crime victim in D.C. There were seven postponements, and so I probably logged, plus the three police officers who were involved in my case, probably logged, 20 hours of seat time to get, 45-minute proceeding.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, I would say delay is definitely a part of the criminal system, and as any crime victim knows, even when the state is prepared or the defense is ready to go, getting a judge and the defense ready to go and the state ready to go all in the same day, when at many times there are opposing interests where maybe one of them wants to go that day and the other doesn't, is a very difficult thing. So I think this bill would not, I think what the key with this would be is making sure, in Oregon, I think it is the district attorney's responsibility to contact the victim and make sure that they know of their right to be usually it's the sentencing, is say if there's a guilty plea, making sure they have a right to be there. And so I don't know that this would, in my experience, most employers are really good about making sure that their employees are allowed to get to these things. But I think it would really, this would be focusing on more making sure that the family and everyone there can be supportive in those. And when it says criminal proceedings, of course, that means the trial, if it goes to trial. But I know that oftentimes when a case does not go to trial, there's a real need on behalf of the victim to make sure that they're there for sentencing and that they can talk to the judge about how a crime has affected their life.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berta, the other thing is, at least in Multnomah County, folks got a 24-hour notice, and I don't know if that's still the case, and I don't know if that was the case with your experience, but cases in Multnomah County were called out the day ahead of time, so at least folks would have some warning.
That's right.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I guess my other concern was, and I wonder if Senator Brown would be able to work on this, I mean, potentially with the immediate family, potentially you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. If there's a lot of siblings and a lot of children, you've got, a dozen employers being required to release employees potentially for something like this. And I'm just wondering if immediate family could be narrowed down some and maybe no limitations in the case of child victims, but narrow down some to keep it from being
this disruptive on a number of employers. I know that probably wouldn't happen very much, but would you be willing to consider that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burke, certainly be willing to look at the definition of immediate family. I think the other thing that's important to note that the bill only would apply to employers with 25 or more employees. So. And there is the hardship exemption for the employer. So I think there's some flexibility built into the bill itself, but I'd certainly be happy to take a look at the definition of immediate family.
Yeah, and I want to, Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you. I think it's just a great idea.
Thanks.
Trying to figure out something that will work smoothly.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to point out to Senator Burdick in Section 6 of the bill. It says that you must take paid accrued vacation leave or other paid leave that you have available. So it's not like you're taking time that is brand new to you that the employer is giving you. Is that correct, Senator Burdick?
It's my understanding that it would be unpaid leave, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, so that it would be unpaid. In terms of whether it's additional, I'd have to take a look at this.
Well, as in sub Q, it says the eligible employee may use any paid leave. So they can have the unpaid leave and then take additional paid leave. Is that your understanding?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that would be correct.
Okay.
If you don't have any paid leave accrued, it would be unpaid leave. Obviously, if you have paid leave, that would be an option available to you.
Senator Walker, or Burdick, excuse me. Do you have another comment, or just comment? Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to clarify something when I answered Senator Burdick's question and to follow up Senator Brown's statement. Normally, the way a case proceeds in a criminal matter, subpoenas are mailed out to the victims who are entered into a computer system. This is how it works in Multnomah County. The subpoenas go out, the victim and the witnesses are confirmed by the state. If they're not confirmed by the state for that date, then obviously you probably have to have a set over. But what Ms. Senator Brown was mentioning was then the day before trial, there is a pretrial negotiation that goes on every day in the courthouse where we try to resolve most of the cases because we wouldn't be able to resolve them all by trial, which is extremely expensive and time-consuming. So that at that pretrial, then we know which cases are going to go the next day. So the victims are usually in phone contact on that day before trial, and at that time they would be told, okay, yes, it is a trial. No, it's not a trial. It's been a set over. Or third, it's not a trial, and it's been set for plea, and this is where you can go to say your piece at the sentencing phase. Just wanted to clarify that.
Thanks.
All right. Senator Brown, anything else?
That would be it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for hearing this bill.
And I think what we'll do is go, since we're on this bill, we'll go to Chris Stringer from the District Attorney's Association.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record again, Chris Stringer, Oregon District Attorney's Association, in support of this bill. I'm the Deputy District Attorney in Benton County. We support the bill. We believe the more crime victims that get involved in the system, it's better for the whole system. It helps keep us more accountable when we're looking at them eye to eye and tell them, hey, this is the deal we made and this is why we made it. And it's good for the court so they get the victim's impact in it. And I understand there's some questions about prosecution and the system. I think Mr. Prince answered all the questions, but I'd be happy to answer any more specific questions as they relate to prosecution and the role the victims play in the system.
Senator Burdick.
In your experience actually prosecuting these cases, if we were to narrow, do you think it would be harmful to narrow somewhat the definition of immediate family?
Well, I don't think on things like, I don't think second cousins or anything like that would usually come in there anyway, but...
They're not in the bill now, but you have... spouse, father, mother, sibling, child, stepchild, and grandparent in the bill now. And do you see all those as being necessary, or do you see that could be narrowed somewhat?
Well, my understanding is on the immediate family, that only applies to the homicide cases, which...
No, actually, the amendment would Well, okay, let's discuss that, because the amendment would extend it beyond homicide cases. The original bill just applies to homicide cases. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, on the homicide cases, we're not talking about a large number of cases on those, because those are pretty rare when they happen. And on the sex abuse, which are going to be the ones where we're really talking about, where the grandparents and other family members are going to come in there. They're not likely to come in on thefts or drug crimes or things of that nature. Drug crimes, there really isn't a victim unless there's a child involved in a meth lab type situation. And so on the sex abuse cases, which is really probably where the amendment, I believe, is going in that direction, I think it is necessary to have grandparents and more immediate family members, because a lot of the times, in those type of cases, the perpetrator is another family member. And so there's those issues of where the child's going to go, and the court a lot of the time wants to hear input from other parties, and it's good if they happen to be right there where they're available.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
So do you feel that the intent can be satisfied by having the immediate family apply to homicides and perhaps to crimes involving, you know, juveniles under 18 or under 16 or whatever?
I think with sexual offenses, yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick.
Thank you.
All right. Great. Thank you. Anything else?
No, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We're going to whip through. Jason Barber is out next.
Chairman, committee members, my name is Jason Barber. I'm the Assistant Director of the Crime Victims Assistance Section with the Department of Justice, and I'm here today to support Senate Bill 610. As the Assistant Director of the Crime Victim Assistance Section, I have day-to-day oversight over the Crime Victim Compensation Program. This program is intended to help out victims of violent crime financially with out-of-pocket costs. And we have about five or six eligibility criteria that each victim must meet in order to gain access. One of those is to cooperate fully with law enforcement officials in the apprehension and prosecution of the assailant. We believe this is a clear statement that policymakers intended for victims to see the case through the criminal justice process, and we feel that this bill would further that process. Would also like to add that we get about 4,000 claims a year. Half of those are child sex abuse cases. So we would actually support the amendment to include, when you have a child victim, to include job protection for their parents, at least.
Any questions? How would you define a child victim? At what age would you...
Right now, I believe it's 17 and under.
All right. Any other questions? Mr. Barber, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Steve Dole and Craig Plunkett.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Craig Plunkett, and I'm a member of Crime Victims United and Parents of Murdered Children. And this is my story pertaining to Senate Bill 610. My story starts out with the death of my son, Eric Plunkett. Eric was murdered September 28, 2000, in his dorm room at Gallaudet University of Washington, D.C. 4 months later, Ben Varner, another student from San Antonio, was also murdered in his dorm room at Gallaudet. Gallaudet is the only liberal arts college / university in the world for the deaf and hard of hearing. Eric was easy prey for the student that murdered him, because Eric had CP, cerebral palsy, from the waist down. He was also profoundly deaf. Eric was strangled from behind and then beat to death with a chair. At the time of Eric's murder, I was working for a company in the Portland area. I had been working for the company for almost 4 years. I was expected to work 47 hours a week. I took off 2 weeks to work to bury my son and to attend all the memorials back in Minnesota and D.C. The first week back, I only worked half days. I felt that I would be pushing my luck if I took more time off for work to grieve. 2.5 months after burying my son, the employer followed me out to my car after work one day and told me to get over my son. His exact words were, "Get over your son. I don't want to hear you mention his name. This business is only here to make money. So I want 100% of your attention on this company." After that talk, I felt intimidated because that was the employer's management style. He even boasted about his management style being intimidation. I didn't want to take time off to go to all the pretrial hearings because I was afraid I was going to get discharged. I did go to a couple of memorials that Gallaudet held for Eric and Ben in February of 2001. I was also called back to D.C. by the grand jury sometime in February of 2001. My wife and I attended the dedication of Eric's dorm room as the Eric Plunkett Video Library in September of 2001. I used my vacation time for most of the trips. The trial started April 21st, 2002 in D.C. By that time, I knew that I would be fired either when I was back in D.C. or the first day back from the trial. I believe the employer was trying to intimidate me to get me to quit before I left for D.C. The trial lasted 5 weeks. The time I took off was charged as leave of absence. The first day back to work, the employer called me into the back room and asked me what my passion was, my son or his company. I told the employer it was my son and his memorial scholarship funds. The employer had read an article written by Margie Belay a week before I came back to work, talking about my passion being Eric's memorial scholarship funds. The employer said he thought he had been fair with me, with my son and me, the last 2 years, but he was going to have to let me go because we had a communication problem. Out of the 10 members of Eric's and Ben's families that attended the funeral, memorials, pretrial hearings, trials, I was the only one let go from my job when I returned to work after the trial. Are there any questions?
I don't think there are any questions. Thank you, Mr. Plunkett.
Thank you.
A very difficult situation to go through.
Thank you, Mr. Plunkett.
Thank you.
Comments?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon and also a member of Parents of Murdered Children. We stand in support of Senate Bill 610, and I would just like to comment that the story you heard from Mr. Plunkett today is just one of many that I've heard over the years that I've been involved with crime victims. It's a tragedy, particularly in homicide cases, that people have to go through this. I might call to your attention also, I know that the chair would recall the Larch Mountain murders that occurred in Portland, I believe it was about 5 years ago. Kathy Dunwoody, the spouse of one of those men who was murdered on Larch Mountain, also went through a similar experience in which she lost her job. As to the bill itself, I would only ask you to, and also I had spoken briefly with Senator Brown, to be very careful about how we define immediate family and also defining these crimes. My suggestion would be this, is that we define the crimes as first and second degree violent felonies, otherwise sometimes referred to as Measure 11 crimes. I think that you will find outside of homicide and outside of child sexual abuse that there's other cases that would warrant and in which family would want to attend the cases. I might note, for instance, a first-degree assault case where somebody has been left with a physical or brain damage, for instance, or where maybe someone over the age of 18, a sister, a spouse, etc., has been raped. So I think we should be very careful about the definitions of those crimes and how we approach that. And I would be happy to take any questions.
Other questions? Well, the bill clearly at this point doesn't cover memorial services or other kinds of related activities, so throw that out there and ask whether or not it ought not include that. The other thing is, Mr. Plunkett, did you work for a company that had more than 25 employees in Oregon?
Mr. Chairman, no, I didn't.
So it was less
than... It was less than 25.
So you wouldn't be covered by this bill. All right. Thank you. Appreciate it. Any other questions? So the question then would be, is whether 25 is too high or not. Thank you very much. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Rebecca Gandy, Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence.
Mr. Chairman, members of committee, my name is Rebecca Gandy. I'm the staff attorney for the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. I don't have any prepared testimony, but I am here on behalf of the member programs that we represent and the victims that we, our programs deal with. I just would like to essentially echo what's been said before and talk about the importance of support people for when crime victims, particularly victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, come to court. It's extremely important that they have the support people that they need in order to ensure their appearance and to support them through the difficult experience of attending court. This bill would help ensure more job security for crime victims and those family members, availability for those family members to be witnesses, as the district attorney mentioned, but also to be support people and be there for those victims when they need to come to court for an emotional experience that support people would certainly be able to assist in. And I would be available for any questions that you might have.
Questions? Senator Brady.
In your experience, what kind of family support people do people want, domestic violence victims want around them?
Okay. In situations of domestic violence and sexual assault, it might very well be, I've just noticed the amendments, that immediate family members might include as much as the Dash 1 amendments suggest. But you don't necessarily need your entire family, and you just need somebody there who can be with you. There's also the Victims Assistance Program with the district attorney and program staff from domestic violence and sexual assault programs that can also attend. But it can be very helpful to have someone in the family attend with you. And if this would make that possible, to have more support people there, then it would be a great idea.
All right. No other questions? Thank you, Ms. Gandy, for your testimony.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It. Given the testimony, then, we'll have some dialogue with Senator Brown, see where she wants to go with the language in the bill, and see if we can find some language that will work, and then bring it back some future date. So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 610. See, Kelly Skye, Andrea Meyer, and Paul Steiner on 729. Is it okay if we hold that over and bring it back? Because I've got a house full of other people on another bill, and I want to try to get to that since we've only got about 40 minutes. But you're all regulars in the building, so. You're all regulars in the building. We see you often, if you don't mind, if that's okay with you.
Chairman, I'm sure they'll be devastated if it doesn't come back.
I'm sure that's probably true. Okay, I think what we're going to do then is move to public hearing on Senate Bill 732, and Council, if you'd explain.
I will, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 732 is the next bill before you. It's related to impounding vehicles upon a conviction for driving while suspended or driving while revoked. This makes a mandatory length of impoundment. I wanted to, if you look at page 1, line 17, for the first conviction for driving while suspended or revoked, the court shall order impoundment for at least 30 days. for a second or subsequent conviction of driving while suspended or revoked, the court shall order impoundment for at least 60 days. And I think that should be a beginning to explain it. Obviously, this is it looks like it's targeted at those who are suspended for driving under the influence of intoxicants. Briefly, there, as you recall from implied consent law, when we all get our licenses, we have an implied consent that we will consent to a breath test. If we refuse to do that, our license is suspended for a year on the first time we refuse. It's suspended for 90 days if we fail the test. And that's independent of a conviction. Yeah, it's longer if you fail. Excuse me, it's longer if you refuse so that the prosecutor can say, he knew he was intoxicated, so he refused, even though he knew he was going to have a longer suspension. At any rate, those are the suspensions for a breath, refusal, or failure. And then there is also a suspension upon conviction for driving under the influence of intoxicants.
All right. And so we have a list of folks to come up. I think probably start with Ann Pratt. Since this bill was introduced at your request, and you want to bring up whomever you want to. And
thank you.
All right, if you just, when you're ready, just
okay.
For the record, then proceed.
Thank you. Chair Menace and members of the committee, I'm Ann Pratt. I'm from Springfield. I'm a member of Crime Victims United and Mothers Against Drunk Driving and Parents of Murdered Children. And I'm also the mother of a DUI homicide victim. We are here today to ask you to pass Senate Bill 732, which addresses driving while suspended, by mandating a 30-day impound for the first offense and 60 days for the second offense. We feel we need to enhance our driving while suspended impound laws by extending the length of impound. Driving while suspended has become an enormous problem in our state. In the year 2002, more than 57,000 driving while suspended convictions were posted. The problem is that although we have impound laws, the suspended driver can have his vehicle back sometimes in a day or two and is back on the road still driving while suspended. The driving while suspended law literally means nothing to many of these offenders. And if these offenders are driving while suspended, that means they also likely, and I don't see how, they could possibly have insurance. Convictions posted for driving without insurance in 2002 was nearly 51,000. Driving under the influence of intoxicants many times crosses over with the driving while suspended. Here are some of the reasons, a few of the reasons for suspensions. Driving under the influence of intoxicants, driving while uninsured, reckless driving, fleeing, attempting to elude police officer, refusal to breath test, blood or urine test, failure to appear. Revocations include murder, manslaughter, criminally negligent homicide, first-degree assault. Kyle William Wilson, the man who killed my son in 1998, has known for a very long time that the laws aren't tough enough to stop him from driving. Before he killed my son, Wilson accumulated numerous speeding tickets, 6 suspensions, an accident, infractions, and 3 driving while suspended. Wilson received another driving while suspended for the DUII and was supposed to be revocated for criminally negligent homicide at his conviction for the death of my son in April of 1999. But after his release from incarceration in December of 2000, he continued down his well-worn path. In 2001, he was again caught and convicted twice, April and August, for driving while suspended, speeding, and of course, no insurance. It was then we learned he had not been revocated by DMV for the criminally negligent homicide conviction. He paid a minimal fine, then retrieved his vehicle and was back on the road again. My biggest fear is he will kill someone else. This is what Kyle William Wilson's driving record looks like. The green is suspension, the red are suspensions, and the green are driving while suspended. And this is the exact behavior pattern, attitude, irresponsibility that we're trying to deter before it turns deadly. As my written testimony, I have included 25 cases of this very same dangerous behavior with the results, and in some of them, there are more than one death involved and serious injury to innocent victims. In closing, I would like to add that Crime Victims United and the Oregon District Attorney Association strongly support Senate Bill 732. Thank you for this privilege and the opportunity to address this serious matter. I am open to any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Pratt? There are none. Thank you. Who's next?
My name is Susan Lombard. And members of the chair, at 7:18 p.m. on September 27, 2001, a Westland police officer clocked Richard Erickson doing 40 miles per hour while traveling in a 25 miles per hour speed zone. He pulled Erickson over, dismounted his motorcycle, and walked toward the Ford Bronco. But Erickson sped away and turned off his headlights in an attempt to elude the officer. His speed was over 100 miles per hour when he crossed the center line and struck my mother's car head-on in the darkness. He drove over the top of her car. He crushed her. He killed her instantly. A police investigation determined that my mother had never left her lane of travel, that she probably never saw him coming, and that she died of massive head injuries. We were not able to see my mother to say goodbye because we were told her body was not viewable. Erickson was not wearing a seatbelt, yet received only facial lacerations and two broken legs. His blood alcohol level was 0.24, three times the legal limit. He had a long history of alcohol abuse and a long police record. He had prior DUIs, his driver's license was revoked, and he had failed the mandatory alcohol diversion program. Yet he had spent no time in jail. He continued to drive without a license until he killed my mother. Under mandatory sentencing guidelines, Erickson has been sentenced to jail for 10 years for his crime. My family and I will have to live with the loss of my mother for a much longer period of time, knowing that her killer was so drunk that he cannot remember his crime. My mother, Phyllis Ruth DeLuna, was a vibrant and active woman. She played tennis several times a week and was an active contributor to her community. Two nights previous to her death, I saw her on her birthday, and we had been out celebrating her 74th birthday. She and my stepfather, Fred DeLuna, had also just celebrated 28 years of marriage. Her will to live was very strong after recently battling and winning a fight against colon cancer. She told me how she had so much living yet to do. How tragic that my mother should die at the hands of a man who had held other human life in total disregard. The bigger question before us today is what we can do to stop these senseless killings by repeat drunk driving offenders. To me, it is a given that everything possible needs to be done to separate the repeat offender from his or her vehicle. Legislation in some states, including our neighboring state of Washington, has been enacted to seize and impound vehicles driven by impaired and suspended drivers. States that have DWI vehicle impoundment laws take the view that hardcore drunk drivers, those who blew well over 0.08 and repeatedly disregard the safety of citizens, must be dealt with more seriously. These new laws allow for vehicles to be impounded for up to 90 days until all fees and fines are paid. Oregonians must do whatever we can to save innocent people from being killed by repeat drunk drivers. When New Jersey Attorney General John Farmer recently enacted the enactment of a DWI vehicle impoundment law, he said, "This legislation is a good law, a compassionate law, and a life-saving law." Thank you for listening to my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Lombard. Appreciate your testimony.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, excuse me. My name is Marie Armstrong, and I'm a member of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, but I'm here today speaking in my own behalf. I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 732. In my investigation into Timothy Hedrick's driving record, I noticed that having a driver's license does not make a person a sound driver if he's not respectful of the laws of the road. I've attached Tim's driving record that will show that this bill could save lives if passed. Tim started showing signs of the coming events in our lives almost a year to the date that he killed my son, Chance. You will see on his record that he has tickets for driving with an open container and speeding. Tim did not stop at killing my son. Driving was suspended. He then had a serious accident by careless driving 6 months after the fatal car crash. Then 3 years later, driving while suspended, he was arrested for drunk driving. This criminal is a danger to the rest of the innocent people that can respect the laws of the road. I believe that if this bill passes, it will keep Tim from driving for a period of time, and this alone could save lives. I urge the committee to consider passing this bill so hopefully no one else will have to walk in my shoes. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any committee members have questions, Senator Ringo?
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony today. I think all of you are right on target, that we can have no sympathy for people that just flout our laws. And I have seen a number of times in my law practice where people have their license has been suspended, and, oh, gee, how did you get to my office? Well, I drove, you know. And we can't tolerate that because of the things you describe. I am a little bit concerned that there may be technical issues relating to the constitutionality of a forfeiture-type law, and so I'm going to be very interested in hearing from the defense lawyers about their objections, and I sure hope we can find a way to overcome their objections, because I think we absolutely need to implement something that serves this purpose. So I just appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Burdick.
Thank you. I had a question for you. You mentioned 90 days suspension or 90 days impoundment. I don't see that in the bill. I think you made reference to a period of 90 days during which they have to pay off their fines.
Mm-hmm. Was in Washington. Mm-hmm.
That's in the Washington law, mm-hmm. I see. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, that sounds like kind of a good idea.
All right. Thank you. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ladies, thank you for testifying. And I just, you know, I was looking through this list of all of the people who've done these very bad things, and it is amazing how almost all of them have had a conviction for driving with a suspended license. And one gentleman had his license suspended 15 times. That to me seems excessive, and that if you've had a suspended license for a percentage of times, you should just lose your license permanently.
Lifetime.
Yes. I don't know. Do you know if that happens? Perhaps counsel can answer that question for me. Yes.
The question again was?
The question is, this gentleman had his license suspended or revoked 15 times. Is there not a limit to that when you just permanently lose your license?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, I'm going to try to answer that off the top of my head. There's several kind of suspensions and revocations. A revocation as a habitual offender, you can seek renewal. I believe there's I want to say it's 10 years. It's quite some time. The only one that I know that is, even the permanent ones, allow after 10 years, you'd have to go to a court and ask them to reinstate your driving privileges, and I can tell you they scrutinize that quite a bit. So I think the issue is the license is suspended, the person just keeps on driving and keeps getting more convictions. And if you look at it that way, I think you can see that the suspension is not an issue, it's in place. Mm-hmm. But it's the continued driving in violation of that.
And that's what this bill is getting at. Thank you.
Finished?
Yes.
Senator Ringo?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, a question for our committee counsel.
What is the maximum penalty for driving while suspended?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, there's two statutes that are mentioned here, 811-175 and 811-182. And driving while suspended is one of those crimes, one of those offenses that's treated in different ways depending on what your suspension is for. So if you look at 811-182, you've got a Class B felony if the suspension is for manslaughter or murder. So you're talking 10 years would be the maximum. The crime is a Class A misdemeanor if the suspension or revocation is any of the following: a suspension under, looks like recklessly endangering with a vehicle, suspension for refusal of a breath test. So for those, it's a Class A misdemeanor. That would be the maximum would be 1 year in custody and a $5,000 fine. The lesser violations, which are in, if you look in this, the bill, are in page 1, line 11, mentions ORS 811-175. Those are violation level suspensions, mm-hmm. meaning it's not a crime. It's like a traffic ticket. And those are for the lesser, you know, I could go through the litany maybe if I could find them. But it's a hierarchy, depending on the seriousness of the act for which you've been suspended.
Mr. Chair, just one
yes,
more.
Of course.
Well, Craig, is there anything that imposes a penalty for repeated violations? Just for example, if you've had 3 suspensions or 5 suspensions, then it's a felony.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, not to my knowledge. It's been hinged on the crime seriousness. Mm-hmm. However, of course, I would hope that the law enforcement, as district attorney, would take into account what the suspension is for and how many there are. But if you continue to get violation level suspensions, you know, there's not much you can do other than have a fine in place.
Obviously. Mr. Kerr, I'm usually not one to advocate increasing penalties or lengthening penalties, but I think this is a big problem for society, and that obviously people aren't getting the message. And maybe there are some difficulties with impounding or forfeiture, but I would certainly entertain increasing punishments for repeated driving while suspended.
Well, I'd like to believe that I'm having some influence on you.
So are the witnesses.
I was going to say, too, if you have good credit, you could probably get a good policy, too. Yeah. So. Senator Burdick?
Mr. Chair, I want to echo both you and Senator Ringo. And I wanted to ask our counsel what the possibilities for going for forfeiture as opposed to impoundment.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, it's a complex issue of forfeiture, but I will make one statement. The measure and the follow-up we did last session was all related to civil forfeiture as opposed to criminal forfeiture. Criminal forfeiture requires a conviction, and there still could be forfeiture on this. And I would be happy to check with forfeiture is a fairly specialized thing. I'd be happy to check with the district attorneys I know that do forfeitures to see where that is. But are you saying hinging forfeiture on this?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. I'm really interested in the heavy duty repeated suspension. At some point, you just go in and you take away their car. It's gone. It belongs to somebody else besides them. At that point, I mean. And again, you wouldn't want to go that route for, it'd have to be pretty serious to go that route. But I think that should be one tool that we at least consider when that would be an option. As you said, Ringo nodding, which means it's totally a good idea.
All right. Thank you very much, ladies. I appreciate your testimony. We do this back and forth kind of thing. It's almost like a Saturday Night Live show occasionally, or Jerry Springer, whichever you might choose. Representative Barker, you're here and wishing to testify on Senate Bill 732. I apologize.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Jeff Barker, State Representative, House District 28. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 732. I'm a policeman of 31 years in Oregon, and I've seen many, many cases of people driving while they're suspended, the drunk driving, One of the last arrests I made as a lieutenant at Fordham was a drunk driver was driving recklessly. When I stopped him, he fled from me on foot. We had to chase him down, track him down to his where he lived. He went into the crawl space under the house. We had to put the police with the beanbag guns in there. We had to put the canine in there. And one of my colleagues said if we'd only had a camera, we could have filmed Dancing with Wolves when the dog and the guy met up in the crawl space. But he was convicted for his fourth, he was a young man, convicted for his fourth drunk driving conviction, which then was a felony. He was facing prison time. The judge in Multnomah County refused to hold him until sentencing. Between the time he was sentenced, he was out again driving with his pregnant girlfriend, got in a wreck, hurt the girlfriend, hurt the other people, and again fled on foot and was captured. If we had impounded some cars, possibly that wouldn't have happened. And I think that's really important. I especially want to thank Chairman Minnis for bringing this bill, for presenting this bill in the beginning. I also want to say over on the House side, we have some additional bills we're working on that would have a severe civil penalty for people who refuse to take the breath test. A big fine if you don't take the breath test, and also will be a process where you will sign acknowledging that that you know about that and that you will not drink and drive when you get your license, just to put people on notice. But I think the being able to impound these cars will keep people from repeating, and also hopefully will keep people from doing it originally. I mean, if they realize it's not a maybe and it's not the car will be towed away and you have to pay a towing fee, but it's going to be impounded for 30 days or 60 days or longer, up to a year, I think that will make some people think twice, like the young man who was suspended, who was driving up the freeway, fell asleep and ran over and severely injured, killed and severely injured the state police sergeant, I believe it was. And so I'm here to tell you I'm in support of it. And while I'm speaking for myself, I'm sure I speak pretty much for the law enforcement community on that.
Thank you. Senator Burdick.
Based on your experience, do you think impoundment would do the job, or do you think we should be at least investigating the possibility of forfeiture?
I think forfeiture would be better if we could do it, but with that constitutional amendment, it becomes more difficult to do that. In many cases, an impoundment might work. I mean, as long as it's substantial, to where I'm guessing some of these cars, by the time the month or two is up, the towing fees and the storage fees are going to be worth more than a car.
Which is what might be why we've got the towing company signed up to testify. Okay. Yes, there we go.
Thank you for testifying, Representative Parker. As I said, I think this is a huge problem we've got to solve. But I have a question about the mechanics of the bill. And I appreciate the committee counsel's input on this. Does the impoundment statute contemplate the person shall pay for the storage charges? I mean, that's not specified in this bill, but I assume that's in some other section of the law.
Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, I know that's the case. It's the case in my experience, and I'm sure. Yeah.
So they have to show up and pay to get their car, and if they never do show up to pay, then they lose the car. I assume that is part of the bill.
The way we in Portland we tow cars for people being suspended, but they can get them back, or no insurance and so on. They have to pay the tow bill. They also have to pay storage fees. And sometimes those get worth more in the car. The people will just leave them there. And then the tow operator then gets the mechanics lien and sells the car. Yeah.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, on page 2, lines 21 to 24 of the bill, that's the area that goes through if it's not claimed within 30 days after the time that they could get it. It goes into that. Those sections are the portions that deal with the mechanics of those liens, et cetera.
Okay. Senator Burdick.
Question to counsel. Maybe this would be a way of funding this bill. Who gets the money under all these ORSs when the vehicle is disposed of? You're supposed to know that off the top
yeah.
of the head.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, I don't know that off the top of the head. I would suspect that there's a tower's lien and they're going to get paid off first. I don't see the marquees here, but I'm sure they would be interested in the security rights of the people who are financing the cars. Be happy to look at that for you to see if there's money that could be redeemed.
Mr. Senator Ringo. Well, I think the answer is that after all the lien holders are paid, they're supposed to send the owner any remaining amount, which of course never exists because the sale process is low.
Okay. Representative, thank you for coming over
thank
and
you.
Sharing with us. All right. Let's see. I've got quite a few people signed up here. So let me see. Chris Stringer, you want to come up? And Bruce Pratt, your wife already testified. Do you want to testify in addition? Or?
Yeah.
Okay, then hang on just a second. Come on up, Mr. Stringer.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name, again, is Chris Stringer. I'm with the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We're in support of this bill. About a month ago, a defense attorney came up to me about an offer on a guy with a couple driving while suspended, and he said to me, why don't you just take these people's car? And I had to hesitate because it sounded like a good idea, but I wasn't sure, coming from a defense attorney, it was something I should be suspicious of. But it was a common sense idea, and this is before I even knew Senate Bill 732 existed. And it's something that our organization supports. Many people have been in that situation as prosecutors. I know I've had a driving while suspended trials where the same officer arrests them as they're leaving the courthouse, something that Senator Ringo alluded to with some of his experience with it. Basically, driving while district attorneys, the most thing that we deal with are the driving while suspended misdemeanor convictions. And something, a question I think maybe Senator Walker might have had, Mr. Chair, was that when you're suspended for driving while under the influence or unauthorized use of motor vehicle, there is a license suspension that's associated with that, no matter if your license was suspended before or not. So if you're already suspended for DUII and you get another DUII conviction, your license will be suspended from the date of the judgment from either 1 year or 3 years, depending on when your last conviction was. If you come in on a driving while suspended misdemeanor conviction, there isn't a suspension associated with it. It's not added another year from that point on or not. It only happens on a designated list of convictions. The most common is driving under the influence of intoxicants. There's some other ones, criminal mischief, maybe 90 days. But there isn't one associated with a new driving while suspended misdemeanor charge. And what happens is when these cases come in, and usually when you see someone's criminal history, they usually have one or two of them on there, they don't tend to get a lot of punishment because jail spaces are only so big, they're full of other people. Usually what they end up with is some kind of maybe court probation or a fine in terms of their sanction. A lot of the time that fine is going to be suspended because of their ability to pay. So basically they walk out with nothing really happening to them. And as a result, driving while suspended isn't really treated very seriously at all in terms of the offenders. They don't treat it seriously. There's no consequences to them. And so we strongly support this bill. What it does is that most of the people that we encounter on a day-to-day basis, their license are suspended because of a driving under the influence conviction. That's the majority of them. The second one I would say would be the habitual offenders. What it does is it'll take that vehicle away from those people who a car is their weapon for the people that are the chronic drunk drivers. And so I'd be happy to answer any questions about prosecution and experience or anything like that.
All right. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stringer, I'm just sitting here thinking about it. And if the tow operator got stuck with a car and a big bill, they're not your typical drunk driver. Is not usually a low-income person. I think often they're middle class. They drive nice cars. Wouldn't that be true?
That's very true. Most of DUI is a very middle-class type of crime that goes across all guidelines. But just in my experience in seeing driving while suspended convictions that go through, usually they'll end up with a fine anyway, and a lot of times that fine is going to be suspended, and the court costs are going to be suspended, and that's just what I've seen, and that is true though. It is a middle class type of crime that goes across the board, but they're not looking at the. It's very rare that jail time is ever given on driving while suspended unless they've had several, and most of the time it's just going to be a fine. Mm.
All right, thank you.
All right, great. Mr. Pratt.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, may I ask Dennis Richards to come up and join me?
Depends on what he's going to say. No, go ahead. Bring him up.
And also, Sergeant Weir was called away, and so he won't be testifying.
Okay.
But, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Bruce Pratt, for the record. I'm a member of Crime Victims United and Mothers Against Drunk Driving. I'm a resident of Lane County. I'm here speaking on my own behalf. Driving while suspended, revoked, and unlicensed is a huge problem in Oregon. 57,000 convictions in Oregon each year. There are other problems. I think that I was out of the room for a short time, but there are other problems associated with driving while suspended, and those include driving without insurance with 51,000 convictions posted, and continued driving under the influence of intoxicants with a combined 22,500 convictions and diversion agreements entered into. The courts have several sanctions available to them. The most promising of these, according to several studies, is vehicle impoundment or immobilization. Impoundment provides for immediate consequences for the offender, which will increase deterrence and reduce unlawful driving by preventing the suspended driver access to that vehicle. Impoundment also provides an appropriate measure of accountability for the registered owners who permit unlawful use of that vehicle. In California, studies have shown that 75% of the drivers that have had licenses suspended continue to drive. That same study showed that drivers with suspended licenses have 3.7 times the fatal crash rate of the average licensed driver. California began the Administrative Vehicle Impoundment Program in January of 1995, whereby the law enforcement officers can impound vehicles on the spot when drivers are caught driving while suspended. The impoundment lasts for 30 days. San Francisco, California safety officials credit the impound law with 63% in alcohol-related fatal and injury collisions. According to San Francisco statistics for the year 1995 and 96, vehicle impoundment program collected $1.5 million in violator-paid administrative fees. And that's an amount that the program administrators consider a break-even amount. Fees also provide, or fees provide reimbursement for the cost of the program. In other words, the police officer's time, a dedicated district attorney, and two clerk salaries. And the costs that result from storage of sometimes exceed the value of the vehicle, which the agency must pay. In conclusion, driving while suspended is an enormous problem in our state. Unless they are stopped for another driving infraction, it is nearly impossible to detect these drivers. One of the most effective ways to reduce the occurrence of driving while suspended is to separate the driver from the vehicle. And thus far, the most promising method, according to several studies, is impoundment or immobilization. Now, in our discussion with Steve Weir when we were talking about coming up here, he said that the private storage facilities have in Lane County plenty of space to, or ample space to store these vehicles. He is in favor of administrative impoundment as opposed to court-ordered impoundment. And I'm tending to go that way, too. And maybe Dennis can tell us a little bit more about the impoundment procedure in California. I'm asking you to please advance Senate Bill 732, and I thank you very much.
All right, Mr. Pratt. Thank you very much. Dennis?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dennis Richards. I'm here on my own behalf. I'm a retired California Highway Patrol Sergeant, 31 years on Highway Patrol. Now, part of my functions for the last 5 or 6 years in California was a part of the administration for our office. I was the administrative sergeant. As part of my duties, I was one of the 3 officers assigned to the area that conduct post-seizure hearings for 30-day impounds. I'm generally here as a resource for you to ask questions. I know you have many concerns regarding how this might be implemented efficiently, effectively, and cost-effectively particularly. And I know that there are many problems that you can foresee with a 30-day impound. When it was originally implemented, I was a supervisor in the field in Santa Rosa, and believe me, we had some serious doubts ourselves as to how we were going to do this. I generally found it wasn't as complicated, though, as it ended up you might visualize in the beginning. The law proposal here I've looked over. I have some personal doubts as to some of the complicated issues involved in your proposal here versus what we implemented in California, particularly as it pertains to the locking devices or boots or whatever. I don't know what the boots system is. It seems kind of cumbersome to me. And we didn't have administrative impounds. These were strictly criminal in nature. We stopped a suspended license driver or someone with multiple DUIs. We would impound the vehicle on the spot for 30 days, regardless of who the owner was. That was one of the other issues in here. It had to be the owner of the vehicle. That's very easily circumvented. These people, in my experience, they're involved in the same issues. They're irresponsible, generally, and they're intelligent. They know how to get around some of these loopholes. Just borrow somebody else's car. Use your boyfriends or girlfriends. These are all issues I've seen numerous times. That's why it was very clear in California. We had a post-seizure hearing process, the policy of our department were very strict as to what we were allowed to release. And originally, in the first year or so of the implementation, there's a learning curve for the public and for the departments, and there were a few problems, and a few teary-eyed people in our office when I told them they're going to lose their car for 30 days regardless of their excuse. But what happens is the public adapts. They learn that I'm going to quit loaning my car to people because if they're not licensed, I'm going to lose it. And as time went on, we found that the post-seizure hearing, the volume that we were dealing with decreased immensely. When I retired 3 years ago, we would probably have 1 or 2 a month at most. And we would seize or impound, not seize necessarily, but impound 3 to 4 cars a day in our county. Now, I understand that the volume of traffic we're dealing with down there is greater than Oregon, and the volume of suspended drivers is greater than Oregon. But the problems percentage-wise probably relate to about the same. We have more fatalities there. We have more injury accidents. Our scope is larger, but the problems are the same. And really, I'm just here to answer any questions you might have regarding any problems we might have come up with when we implemented this law. And I don't see where it would be as complicated as you made it in this proposal. It could be simplified a little bit, taking some of the little loopholes out that seem to be a concern of some law agencies here. So, all right. If you have any questions of me, I'd be
Do you
happy
live
to
in Oregon?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Whereabouts?
Springfield.
Springfield. So, okay, good. We might just tap your expertise here. Senator Walker's question or two?
Yes.
Comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Richards, welcome to my county.
Thank you.
I noticed 2 things. One addresses an issue Senator Burdick raised that perhaps, you know, she wanted to know where the fees went. In California, it says here in the materials that Mr. Pratt provided, police say that a key element of the program's success is that the fees pay for a district attorney to prosecute the resulting cases. Did you have that experience?
No. California Highway Patrol, which is the agency I work for, we did not accept administrative fees even to cover any costs we had, although they were minimal. You have to understand that there's not much difference between doing the paperwork and the time necessary to impound a car for 30 days as there is for a normal storage. You fill out the same form, you file in the same file, you dispose of it the same way. The only difference was on the front of it, it had 30-day impound stamp on it. And so when the clerk pulled that file out to release the vehicle, that was really all she saw. We store cars as a matter of routine on a daily basis. The time involved didn't require that much, so our department did not collect administrative fees to release it. However, some cities, if not most of them, and most county agencies did. And they would recoup their clerical staff and administrative fees at the time the vehicle is released. The person coming down to retrieve the vehicle is required to go to the office where the vehicle is stored and get a release form. So that office now knew that vehicle is going to be released. So when they went down to the towing yard, they had to take that release form with them, stating that the agency that originally impounded the vehicle authorized its release. The time they came to the police agency to get that dismissal, they would pay an administrative fee to that agency. It varied by city, county to by county. Our particular department, mine, Highway Patrol, did not collect any fees for that.
And then my follow-up question is, I don't know if you're familiar with the City of San Francisco, how they implemented it, but also in the materials provided by Mr. Pratt, said the city makes money off the program because they require people to pay all their outstanding parking tickets and get valid registrations. Excuse me, so it brings in $500,000 a year into the city.
And some cities will require that you pay their parking tickets and fees, but that's not profit for the agency, for the police department. That would go into the county fund.
Mm-hmm.
But again, as I said, California Highway Patrol, we didn't collect any of those fees.
Right.
We just, it wasn't a significant impact on our administrative operation because it really didn't involve much more legwork than normal storage.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to try to get through a few of these people. We've got a Lieutenant Ed Stollard from Lincoln County. I want to get to you before the time runs out, so you don't have to come back.
Thank you, sir. Chairman Minnis, County Committee. No, I better move this first. Good morning. I'm Lieutenant Ed Stollard, Lincoln County Sheriff's Office, and I'm here today representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. And I find myself in an enviable position of speaking in opposition to Senate Bill 732. As a law enforcement officer, any tools that we can get to solve the problem of driving under the influence and driving while suspended are good. But as a manager, when I have to look at implementing this bill as it's written, I see a lot of problems with this. First of all, Oregon has an impound law. It could certainly be strengthened. But under Oregon's current law, the impound is immediate. The owner has to redeem the vehicle by having a valid licensed driver, providing proof of insurance on that vehicle, and then paying towing, storage, and administrative fee. This bill, as it's written, would create, in my opinion, a complicated program of tracking impounded vehicles, installing and removing immobilization devices, excuse me, and record keeping for those vehicles impounded under Section 6. In addition to that, vehicles impounded and not recovered by the owner would become my problem to deal with. I would have to dispose of them, usually by calling a wrecking company and paying them $50 to $100 out of my budget to remove those vehicles. Most law enforcement agencies in the state of Oregon don't own immobilization devices, and unlike Lane County, I certainly don't have room for the 200 vehicles that I would impound that I cited for last year. In Lincoln County, most tow companies don't have that kind of room. If I had to impound half of the vehicles that I cited for last year, I would quickly overwhelm my storage capacity and all the private tow companies we have. You also have to understand that if we impound a vehicle, we are responsible. We are liable for any damage to that vehicle. So they have to be secured in a place where we can reasonably expect that they're not going to get damaged.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Sheriff, I'd just like to ask you some questions. You don't have the capacity to impound lots of vehicles, but I'm curious, of the vehicles that you do impound, how many of those are just, they're financially upside down, and people completely walk away from them and just say, forget it?
Chairman, Senator Ringo, I'm going to take a wild stab at this and say that probably 25% of the vehicles that we do impound are never recovered.
Okay, and of those, some have lien holders, some don't have lien holders.
Correct.
Mr. Chair, is that?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay, and the ones that don't have lien holders, that's not a financial loss to you. You could sell those vehicles at least for scrap. They're probably worth $500 or $1,000 if they drive.
Chairman, Senator Ringo, those vehicles are what I would describe as disposable. They're of absolutely no value. They're driven until they break down, or we impound them. Quite frankly, the people never expect to redeem them.
Right.
They just walk away.
But can you not even sell them to a scrapyard for a couple $100?
No, sir. We will have to pay one of our two wrecking yards to come get them, usually $50 a car.
I see.
To remove them for us.
Okay. And then the lien holder is pretty much, if there is a lien holder, then you still don't get any money because the lien holder is going to come first.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Any more?
Just a couple more comments, if I may, sir. The other problem that the sheriffs have with this bill is that it disproportionately impacts sheriff's offices because we not only are responsible for the citations and the impounds that our deputies make, but if the person is, if the vehicle is impounded, is cited in another jurisdiction, but they reside in our county, it's the sheriff's responsibility as the official who attends to the court to serve that court order. I would point out, I think there is some remedies to this bill. I noticed that the bill says that the court shall impound when the person is driving while suspended. It says it may impound if the person is driving while under the influence. And I think if you reverse that and require an impound when the person is convicted of driving while under the influence and may impound when they're simply driving while suspended, I think that the sheriffs could probably support this. Another...
Hang on, Senator Brady.
Would you say that again? I think you reversed your words. You wanted to say what? May?
I believe that if the bill says that the court may order an impound when the person is convicted of driving while suspended and shall order an impound when the person is convicted of driving while under the influence, that the sheriff could support that.
And why would that be?
Number one, volume is a lot less. Most of the speakers I've heard today are addressing those DUI drivers, and those are the ones that I think have to be impacted.
So, Mr. Chairman, if a person was driving while suspended and they were also drunk, then that would fall under the shall language.
Chairman, and Senator Burdick, that's correct.
Mr. Chairman,
Council.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to clarify something. There's one thing that I think we might get a little confused on. This bill deals with 809-700 for court-ordered impoundment. So that would be after a conviction. And that's opposed to 809-720, which allows impound by an officer. So there's an impound that can happen immediately upon arrest or citation. And I want to make sure we have those two in mind clearly, because an officer could currently impound a vehicle for suspension or DUI at the time of citation and take it to the tow lot.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
What is the process for forfeiture if we were to change the conviction, change the impound to forfeiture? What impact would that have on the sheriffs?
Chairman Minnis, Senator Burdick, Lincoln County currently has a civil forfeiture program. We, upon conviction, forfeit a person's vehicle after they've been convicted of their second DUI. Prior to Measure 3, that money went into a DUI forfeiture account, which we used for training and equipment related to DUI enforcement. Post Measure 3, that money now goes into a separate account for drug and alcohol treatment.
That's right.
But the effect is excellent in our county because there is a process that protects innocent owners, protects lien holders, but it takes the vehicle away from the offender.
Yes.
If you were to add forfeiture for driving while suspended, then that would just be more of a good thing?
Chairman, Senator Burdick, forfeiture for driving while suspended is going to have many of the same problems because you have to have a conviction before you can forfeit the vehicle. So you still have the storage problems, actually longer storage problems than just with an impound.
No, I don't understand.
Perhaps I misunderstood the question.
If you had to have a conviction anyway, why would that be different?
We'll bring this back. We're bringing it back on Thursday to finish the public testimony on the bill. We'll have counsel kind of go through some of those questions and even line them out for us because we are talking about a multiplicity of different issues, and the forfeiture issue is one that always gets unbelievably complex.
Yeah.
So, all right. Thank you very much, Sheriff.
Thanks, sir.
Appreciate your testimony. And everyone else who has signed up, you'll have to come back Thursday. We're out of time, and we'll
adjourn the meeting. I want to know what can be said.